Chapter 5. While Chang and I waited in the Red Room for the railguns to start, Valois went back to my home to bring Nicola and Victorine to Sanctum. "The heads have emerged over the horizon line," Cantor reported. "In about 30 seconds we should have a clear view of the upper half of both suits." "Open fire at your discretion," Chang said, "but single shots only, unless I say otherwise." Then to me, "My units are in position. Brighton Bucks ready and demolition fuses laid along the last 100 meters of the tunnel. Be a nuisance having to dig it out again, but if that's what it takes, are we convinced that the power drop was orchestrated by Glass? I still think it might be worth rushing her with axes, seeing how much of this is a bluff." I shook my head, resigned to our powerlessness. "None of it's a bluff. She deactivated my weapon, interfered with power and life support throughout an entire section of Sanctum. And she's been accessing data records, all from that bed. I think if we could see what's inside that skull, instead of what she wants us to see, it would freeze us cold. And I believe every one of her threats."
"What does she want with you?"
"I don't know. Some nonsense about killing wolves. Listen, Alma, I'm prepared to believe her threats. That doesn't necessarily mean I think she's sane." "Powering up both railguns," Cantor called. The lights dimmed, the usual drain on our resources. Around the Red Room's walls, power dials fluctuated, then climbed back to normal levels. "Slugs away," Cantor said. At 100 kilometers per second, the impact was nearly instantaneous. Screens, relaying remote feeds from surveillance eyes, registered an immense white flash lifting off the ridge. In the airless environment, the flash dispersed very rapidly. "Confirm the kill," I said, as if every analyst gathered in the Red Room was not already focused on that task. "Negative kill," Cantor said. "Both suits." Cantor stumbled over their words, as if not quite believing them. "Both suits intact, still proceeding."
"Impossible,"
Chang said, as if a firm refutation was all that was needed. "Did the guns misfire or did something neutralize the slugs?" I asked.
"Negative misfire, targeting solutions validated," Cantor said.
"Fire 2 more slugs, Chang ordered.
The power dipped, the guns discharged, and another white flash. We waited.
"Negative kill, suits intact."
"She's got a countermeasure. Something,"
Chang said, a crack of desperation opening in her voice.
"Or she has control of the guns,"
I replied. "I can believe it, given what else I've seen her do." Chang leaned into the table.
"Advance teams, move into outer lock and report visual acquisition."
"Order countermanded," I called out. "Fall back to the pressure door at the 18-kilometer marker, and get there fast."
4 slugs remaining in each railgun," Cantor said. "Shall we fire 2 more?
I nodded. "Try it." We waited again, Chung confirming that her teams were in the process of retreating 2 kilometers back down the tunnel, to the point where they would be protected in the event of an immediate decompression.
"Negative kill, and—"
Cantor was staring down at a pattern of numbers on the edge of the table.
"Guns are retargeting. Both railguns slewing."
"Lock them out," I snapped.
"Override's not accepted. Guns are acting autonomously."
I shook my head. "I wish they were."
"Continuing to slew," Cantor said, "passing 180 degrees.
"The safeties will prevent them aiming directly at any part of Sun Hollow," Chung said, with a fracturing confidence.
270 degrees, Cantor intoned. "Aiming points are converging on the outer lock."
I looked to the lights. They were growing dimmer. "Where are your teams, Alma?"
"I don't know. On their way."
The room shook. Dust shaking off the ceiling, prisms toppling over on the table. 20 kilometers away, a pair of fists had just struck the crust of Michaelmas. The monitors covering the surface went blind in the same instant.
"Weapons cycling for 2 more shots, Cantor said.
I bellowed,
"Glass! Stop!
Whatever point you need to make, you've made it."
"You think she can hear you in here?"
Chang asked.
"I think she can hear me anywhere."
I lowered my voice, realizing that I had never needed to raise it in the first place. "Glass, You've got me. You can blast your way into us. I believe it now. And if you run out of slugs, I don't doubt that you can override every airlock in Sun Hollow. Our safety interlocks won't stop you. You can probably blow all our air if you want to. But you don't have to. It's done. I raised my hands in a gesture of surrender. It's done. You have me. Then, to Chung, word on your teams?
Nothing yet.
Glass, let them live. I'll come to you. Whatever you want. Cantor said, we've lost all telemetry from the end of the tunnel. No idea of pressurization, lock status, if there even is a tunnel anymore. Close all intermediate locks. If the air's venting out into vacuum, we won't know it for a minute or so.
Miguel, said Valois,
returning to the red room with Nicola and Victorine right behind him, all three of them looking just as confused and frightened as the rest of us.
What the hell is she doing to us?
I moved over to them, clamping my hands around Valois' shoulders. I need a moment alone with my wife and Victorine, if that's all right. Nicola wrenched me away from Valois.
No.
Whatever you are about to say, no. Some part of our predicament must have been communicated to her in the journey to Sanctum.
I have no choice. We have no choice. Glass wants me.
I had never looked into another person's eyes as fiercely and deeply as I looked into hers.
I have to go with her. If I don't, if we keep resisting, she'll keep damaging Sun Hollow until she gets what she wants anyway. And that will hurt you far more than losing me.
We can kill her.
Nicola's voice was a monotone, the shock of my declaration hitting her like a bereavement.
There must be a way to kill her.
There might be, I said, but not without terrible risk to ourselves, and still with no way of eliminating whatever part of herself got into our systems. Kill the body, the soul of Glass remains. I wish it weren't so simple. Victorine had grasped enough of what was under discussion to ask,
How long does she want you to go away for?
I had two choices then, the consoling lie or the blunt truth. As cruel as it might have seemed, I was doing Victorine a longer-term kindness by speaking honestly.
Forever.
You do not know that,
Nicola interjected. Glass must have a ship of her own, I answered, an interstellar ship. It's out there somewhere. She mentioned a place called Charybdis, presumably a planet. But it's not one any of us have ever heard of. That means it must be some way out beyond any of the settled systems, which means I'll be gone a very, very long time. How long, I couldn't say. But our lives are short now. I pulled Victorine to my chest, tears stinging my eyes.
I'm sorry. I'm so, so sorry.
I wanted to see you grow up. I wanted to see you become the great person I know you will be. And, Nicola, I turned to her mother. You shared these years with me and let me know something of a daughter's love. I'll carry my gratitude for that wherever I go. You are both more than I ever deserved. All objection was gone from Nicola's voice now. She knew I had made my mind up. All that was left was heartbreak.
She should not have done this to us.
No, I agreed, forcing a wry smile through my own tears. She shouldn't, and I don't agree with any part of it. But here, today, I matter less than Sun Hollow. I stooped down until my face was level with Victorine's. I dipped a hand under her chin, forcing her watering eyes to meet my own.
This is the worst thing that's ever happened to you. But you are strong and good, and it will not destroy you.
I'll carry your love for me wherever I go, and you'll keep mine with you in Sun Hollow. And you'll live and grow and love. And you will make your mother proud, and I will always be proud of you both.
Kill her for me,
Nicola said.
And for me,
Victorine said, when the chance comes, which it will. Nicola breathed heavily. She kissed me, then stood back.
You are a good man, Miguel.
We shall remember you, but you must remember us as well. Wherever you go, whatever happens,
Hold this in your heart. You are a good man, and you are loved.
Orders were issued not to obstruct us. We walked unimpeded from the infirmary, out beyond Sanctum, past my empty home, out to an electric cart waiting to carry us down the long tunnel. By then, we had word that Chung's team had made it to the relative sanctuary of the 18-kilometer pressure door, and since they were instructed not to defend the tunnel, nor delay the suits, we passed them as they returned to Sanctum, shaken by their narrow survival. They had been much closer to the impact points when the railguns turned on us, but otherwise uninjured. Beyond the pressure lock, the last 2 kilometers of the tunnel had been blasted open to the sky, ruptured by a combination of the railgun strikes and the premature detonation of the demolition fuses. The suits had a clear path down a deepening furrow until they arrived at the other side of the pressure lock. Glass told me to instruct Sanctum to close the 16-kilometer door behind us, sealing us in a 2-kilometer tube of air. We got off the cart and walked to the door. Through a thick pane of glass I saw the suits waiting, like pale ghosts on the other side. It was a door, not a lock. There was air on this side of it, vacuum on the other. Either we had to go through the door, or the suits had to come to our side. Either way would result in the decompressive venting of all the air bottled into those 2 kilometers. "How do we do this?" I asked. "Presuming you have a plan."
"Don't try and hold the air inside your lungs."
I looked at her, skeptically.
"Because you don't want me to die. Because I don't want to have to go to the trouble of growing you new lungs. Although given the work I will have to do with you anyway, perhaps I'll treat you to some new ones after all."
"Nice of you not to suggest we brought vacuum equipment with us. I suppose that thing inside you is a life support device." Glass tilted her head, mulling on her answer.
"I suppose it is, but I won't be depending on it to get me across a few seconds of vacuum. The suits will close around us. Try and stumble into yours if you wish, or just wait for the suit to come to you."
I had been through enough decompression exercises to heed Glass's warning not to retain the air in my lungs. She moved her hand to the manual release on the door, and I took one deep breath to flood as much oxygen into my blood as I could. Then I breathed out, and Glass opened the door. I remember no part of what happened next. I suppose we were blown out of the lock by the force of the escaping air. At some point I came around to a foggy awareness that I was warm, and breathing, and being made to walk like a sleeping soldier propped up by his marching colleagues. We were above ground, trudging across terrain that had already been gouged and scarred by the railgun strikes. Me in one suit, Glass in the one to my left, walking in lockstep. I tried to resist that motion, to lag behind her, but the suit's movement was far stronger than my own muscles.
"Don't resist it. In time, I'll allow you almost complete command of the suit and its functions. But not today. Not while your nerves are still a little raw."
"Did you hear the promise I made to Nicola and Victorine?"
"About killing me? Yes."
"You don't think I have it in me?"
"I think you need to be realistic about your chances."
"I've seen your capabilities, Glass. I've seen how easily you outdid us, how easily you could have killed us all. I've also seen how quickly you can move. Mentally and physically, you might be the most dangerous entity I've ever encountered. But you're not invulnerable. You were frightened of that axe just for a second. Nothing you could have done about it. You couldn't metabolize it. And you make mistakes. I saw that thing inside you."
"How can you be sure I didn't want you to see it?"
"Because the other thing you're not so good at is lying. I think you're so good at being nearly perfect that you haven't had much practice at being human."
"You've read me so well. How do you propose to kill me?"
I shrugged inside the suit. "I'll have to find a bigger axe, won't I?" Glass halted, and so did I. She lifted a hand, beckoning something from the sky. A ship enlarged above us, a cruciform blackness blotting out the stars, a vaguely conical hull with a slight swelling near the rear, sharp nose, and 2 engine outriggers.
"This is Scythe, Moray class, with augmentations, fast
dark and extremely agile. It's going to be your home for some time to come, so get used to it.
If wolves followed you here, that time might not be long.
They never saw me. Scythe knows how to keep to the shadows, to keep upwind of them. Inhibitor swarms are ruthless and powerful, but slow to adapt to changing parameters. That's our only hope. Adapt fast and find something that catches them off guard.
You have weapons in that thing?
Yes, very potent weapons, but only enough to slow them down. What I have is maximum stealth. They can't see my engines, can't see my hull. Dark drives, cryo-arithmetics, camelioflage, non-envelope light path manipulation, plus 6 or 7 other things you'd need neural augmentation to understand.
Glass stretched out her hand, magicking open a glowing rectangle in the blackness above. A ramp tongued down until its lower end made contact with the ground. We stepped aboard, and the ramp retracted back into Scythe, delivering us into an airlock. I felt movement, a heaviness in my belly. We were already lifting away from Michaelmas. I had no sense of air flooding into the chamber, nor any indication of it within the suit. But at a certain point my helmet clicked and peeled itself back. Glass's helmet did likewise. Then the rest of our suits opened so we were able to step out of them, wearing only what we'd had on in Sanctum. The empty suits shuffled back against the airlock wall, then were absorbed to about half their depth. How many people are here?
Just me. And now you.
I considered the time Glass had been away from Scythe. This whole ship runs itself. It must be 0.5 kilometer long.
Not far off. And yes, it does mostly run itself. We can communicate neurally, me and the ship, but only in relatively close proximity. Other than that, well, it's quite clever. For a ship.
I hope it's got a good brig.
Oh, I won't be locking you away. What sort of manners would those be? No, this ship is yours now. You may explore as you wish. If there's a part of it that I don't wish you to access, Scythe will rebuff you, gently at first, and then with escalating force.
Those are the rules.
Those are the rules.
Good. Here are mine. Despite what you've said and the warnings you've given, I am going to find a way to kill you.
Good. I like a man with a goal.
I'll keep looking for opportunities. One will arise, if I'm patient enough.
Scythe will kill you.
But at least you won't have the satisfaction of witnessing it. And if I find a way to kill you, stay alive, and turn this ship around, I'll take it. There won't be a moment when I'm not thinking of that. Just so you understand.
I'm relieved.
If the man I sought hadn't made such a promise, I'd start to worry that he wasn't going to be much use to me. She reached out, took my chin and angled my face so that our eyes locked. Her fingers were vice-like, the nails digging in sharply.
It's no lie, is it? I can see the hate in your eyes. So much hate.
What did you expect?
Hate helped. Hate is useful.
She made a flicking gesture, batting aside the dark business that floated between us.
That said, may we at least pretend to move onto a more civil plane of discussion? Come forward. I'd like you to see the control room.
We went forward or up, depending on my shifting perspectives. Scythe had parked over Michaelmas in a belly-down configuration, as far as I could judge from that starless, hovering form, and then pushed away from the surface at the same orientation. But now the thrust was coming from the rear of the ship, along its longitudinal axis, and the local gravity had shifted through 90 degrees. Floors and walls had swapped function without fuss, corridors constricting or bulging, doors sealing and opening in accordance with the changing geometry. The control room was a spherical chamber, dominated by 2 monstrous acceleration chairs, the sort that came equipped with an arsenal of life support devices so a person could endure days or even weeks of constant operation. Both chairs were mounted on bulky gimbals and pistons that allowed for rapid orientation shifts,
compensating for any breakneck manoeuvres that Scythe might be required to make. A certain number of controls and displays were built into the chair's armrests and head supports, while the rest were farmed out to the spherical walls, grouped into functional stations to which either of the chairs could be guided. There were screens, fold-down control panels, and a narrow ribbon of wraparound windows. The view through the windows, looking down at the face of Michaelmas as it fell away beneath us, looked convincing, but it was almost certainly false, relayed through tens of meters of hull cladding. If glass had gone to as much trouble to make her ship invisible as she claimed, windows were the last thing it needed.
"Take a seat," she said.
I eased into the leftmost chair. It turned out to be far more comfortable than any of the acceleration couches on our shuttles. Pressure supports adjusted silently, conforming to my body shape. I ranged my hands across the built-in controls, trusting that anything dangerous would have been locked out at the system level. Diagrams and menus sprang into life across the screens fixed to the chair, and those on the walls within my field of view, all annotated in Kinesian. Almost as soon as I had taken note of that, they morphed into Russish. Not some random variant of Russish, either, but the era dialect with which I was most comfortable. How did it do that? Glass was busying herself in her own seat. She made much less use of the tactile controls, her hands forming stiff, dancer-like gestural shapes, but not actually contacting any of the surfaces.
It reads visual saccades, involuntary eye movements. It maps the way your attentional focus skips across certain symbols and dwells on others. From that, it uses a predictive model to determine that Russish is your preferred tongue. Did it do well?
She would have seen through a lie instantly. Yes, but hardly anyone in Sun Hollow uses Russish. I'd almost forgotten it was easier for me than Kinesian.
You might have forgotten. Your brain didn't.
Old wiring is slow to learn new tricks. She made another flicking gesture and I heard a series of rapid thuds from somewhere aft of us. Through the arc of the windows I caught movement. Several dozen small objects erupting away from us, showing up as dark specks against the face of Michaelmas. They drifted on natural trajectories for a few seconds, growing smaller, then accelerated on widely varying courses, darting to all quarters of the horizon like a shoal of fish spooked by the arrival of a predator. What are they?
The first of my parting gifts. Consider them an upgrade to your current defense arrangements, which were, shall we say, a little lacking. These will supplant your existing networks of seismophones and railguns. You'll have better eyes, ears, and teeth. The packages will conceal themselves and tap into your surface cables, repairing them with self-replicating sheathing. They'll digest and reprocess your existing sensors and guns for raw material.
You said nothing on the ship was good enough to stop wolves.
It isn't, and these upgrades won't stop them either. But they'll serve Sun Hollow well in other respects. More reliable, more sensitive, more accurate. If another ship blunders into your system, or, perish the thought, another interloper such as I, then you'll be far better prepared.
I could imagine no reason why Glass would overstate the benefits of the packages, nor go to the trouble of dispensing them if they did not offer a significant improvement on our existing arrangements. I need to contact Sun Hollow. Tell them what's happening.
There's no need. There'll be a little bit of me in Sanctum from now on, coordinating your security.
Coordinating or overriding?
So little gratitude, she said chidingly. But don't worry. They'll get used to me very quickly, and in time they'll realize that I'm actually on their side. I want Sun Hollow to survive. You're not alone. There are other pockets of life out there, other doughty little bands of survivors, huddled down against the night. But at any point, one or more of those groups could fail, or be found by the wolves. So each must be considered irreplaceable.
You have a strange way of showing charity.
Charity. Interesting choice of word. Did you think about faith and hope at the same time? But it's not that, Miguel. It's species-level insurance. My gifts don't end with these packages either. While Scythe was on its way to fetch me, I had it send out drones to meet your disciples. It helped me to blind you a little, but I assure you that was only temporary. One by one, the disciples have been injected with self-replication packages similar to those I've sent to the surface. When the disciples return to life, they'll be much improved. Again, it's nothing that will stop the wolves. But if you have early warning of their approach, you'll have more time to shut down your noisier processes and sit tight.
You know a lot about wolves, or seem to.
I've made it my life's work. Someone had to.
She gestured at the window, where the horizon of my world was already tightening, closing towards a circle.
Say goodbye to Michaelmas, Miguel. It'll be a faint, fading pebble the next time you see it.
I looked at my home for a few seconds, until the thought of Nicola and Victorine still down there, never knowing what would become of me, me never knowing what would become of them, our lives strung together by a lengthening bond of grief, became too much for me to bear, and in shame and despair I averted my eyes. Glass was wrong. There would not be a next time.
Chapter 6. In another part of the ship, a table had been laid for dinner. Plump back chairs faced each other, with plates, cutlery, glasses, bottles and jugs set between them. Candle flames wavered in Scythe's air circulation currents.
If you want me to eat, just give me some food I can take back to my quarters.
No, I insist. And when I say insist...
Glass indicated the chair facing the window.
Take that one. They say it's polite to let guests have the view.
Rather than argue with her, sensing how futile it was likely to be, I took my seat. Glass took up the opposing one, with the windows ranged behind her back. There was no sign of Michaelmas now, only the ruddy smear of the dust disk, pricked by a few of the brighter stars. There must have been some trick of contrast going on, because even the candlelight should have washed out my view of those stars. Glass poured wine for me without asking.
Let's begin anew, Miguel. Let's put all that bad business behind us. I've taken you from your family, and that's not a thing I expect you to thank me for. But I guarantee in time you'll see matters in a different light. Until then, we are obliged to share the ship. Share the ship, share in my quest. And insofar as your survival is predicated on my own, look out for each other.
She dropped her voice, confidingly.
We're heading for dangerous waters, sea monsters and peril, but at the end of it will be a prize worth all our travails.
Charybdis,
you were paying attention after all. Now shall we agree to a truce of sorts? My ship is your ship.
She raised her own glass and encouraged me to raise mine.
A toast, but not to me, or even to us. It's far too soon for that. You despise me, and I understand your feelings. But to your friends, and mine, and our mutual struggle against the wolves. The night is cold, the forest full of terrors, but there is a glimmer of light on the horizon.
To my friends, I allowed.
And to mine.
And pray they never meet, I continued, because whatever you are, and whoever or whatever sent you, I want no part of it.
My friends aren't the same as me.
Glass sipped from her wine, and I sipped from mine, and as much as I wished it to be otherwise, it was heady and delicious. Nor did I care that the wine might contain anything, or that it would very likely cloud my judgment. I was on Glass's ship now, entirely at the mercy of whatever she wanted to put into my body or take out of it. If I allowed myself to draw a breath of air, I might as well drink her wine.
What can I possibly offer that you can't already do for yourself, I asked her,
or have this ship do for you?
You'll have proven your worth by the time we get to Charybdis.
Which is where, exactly? I didn't think I'd ever heard of a planet called Charybdis, so I checked Sun Hollow's libraries. No mention of any such place.
Then you'll have to trust that it exists. But I'll help with part of your confusion. The reason the name doesn't show up is that it's one I gave to the place, not anything official.
Then where is it?
In a system within easy reach of this ship.
But still decades of flight away. Glass gave a hopeless shrug, as if we were both caught up in a situation that had nothing to do with her interventions.
Space is deep. What can you do?
White spheres floated into the room. They were some kind of servitor, each about the size of a human head. Multi-jointed arms came out of each sphere, holding the steaming plates containing our first course. The plates contained a selection of dumplings, glistening with drizzled sauces. The spheres set the dishes down, then departed. If the wine had been superlative, the dumplings required a vocabulary I no longer possessed. It might have been the contrast with the diet in Sun Hollow, but I could not remember anything more delicious, or anything better suited to the fading preferences of my palate. I was a blind man, rediscovering colour.
To your taste?
Don't expect gratitude. I paused, swallowed another morsel of dumpling. But you were right about your ship. It cooks very well. I made to set down my knife, then hesitated with it still between my fingers. It was heavy, made of some cold, solid alloy. It was not as long or as sharp as I might have wished, but it could still do some useful damage if I were quick enough. Glass pushed aside her plate.
You're thinking about stabbing me. You're debating with yourself whether or not you could spring across the table speedily enough to reach me. There's another part of you wondering if the knife will melt in your hand the instant you try to do some harm with it, or even if it will turn itself against you.
She must have expected me to put down the knife in befuddlement, astonished that she had read my intentions so unerringly. She must also have thought, I would ask, how such a feat of mind-reading were possible. Instead, I lunged across the table with all the force I could muster, the knife before me, scattering plates and glassware, only thinking of whether it was better to go for the eye, the throat, or the chest. I was ready to hack and stab at her until she died. I was ready to test her promise all the way. Glass did not seem to move. There was simply a discontinuity. She was in a different position, blocking me with her right arm and seizing my knife hand with her left. I stopped, as if I had impacted an iron framework, an armature welded into the shape of a woman. Glass did something to my wrist, barely a pinch, and the knife tumbled away. Then she held me in that posture, suspended over the wreckage of the table, our faces only a hand's width apart.
"I don't blame you for trying," she said,
as calmly as if we were still continuing our conversation.
"It would have been all too easy for me to bluff."
She reached out and retrieved the knife, then slid it back over to my side of the table, through a tide pool of spilled wine. Then she relaxed her hold on me, giving me a gentle shove back in the direction of my seat.
"Try again, just so you're absolutely clear. Go for it, with all your will. This time I won't make any sort of countermove. Scythe will intervene instead."
She dipped her hands into her lap, beneath the table.
"No, please, try. It will be instructive."
I thought about it for a second, then pushed the knife further away. My hand contained a little hot star of pain where she had pinched my nerves together. There wouldn't be much point.
"You're learning."
Glass looked to the door. The spheres came in again and quickly tidied up the mess I had made. The throb in my wrist was starting to die down.
"See the larger picture,"
she continued, lifting her goblet again.
"Make that adjustment, no matter how hard it seems. Come with me and find something that will make a difference against the wolves. Show, if you will, the ultimate love for those close to you."
The spheres brought in the main course. I had no wish to continue playing the subservient guest to my domineering host, but that was only my pride having its say. My appetite was perfectly willing to debase itself. "Back in Sanctum," I said, lifting my knife by way of emphasis, rather than with the intention of stabbing, "you said something that puzzled me."
"Did I?"
"You were making a point about the ethics of intention. To serve as an example, you dredged up the Butcher of Tharsis." Glass cocked her head.
"I suppose I did."
"Why him?" "You had all of history to play with. any number of despots and madmen. Why did you settle on the Butcher of Tharsis, out of all the possibilities? She met my question with one of her own.
Did they teach you much about him?
Enough that I remember that his name was Neville Clavaine. I ate on for a few mouthfuls. A military figure, something to do with Mars. A long, long way back. 500 or 600 years, I suppose.
He was involved in the first war against the Conjoiners,
Glass said, leaning in with a sort of scholarly eagerness, as if she had just learned something and was itching to parade her knowledge.
He tried to crush them, tried to stop them from happening.
He earned that name because of the excessive brutality and cruelty of his methods. He'd probably have said he was just doing his job as a soldier.
I'm inclined to take the same view,
Glass said, surprising me.
Different times. We mustn't be too censorious. But a man like that, a man prepared to go to extremes in the interests of a military end, he'd be quite useful to have around now, wouldn't you say?
My quarters were several times more comfortable and well-equipped than any chambers I had known in Sun Hollow. They consisted of several linked rooms. There was a bedroom, a small lounge, a toilet, a bathroom with a weightless shower and washing basin, which even ran to a selection of soaps, oils, unguents, and grooming accessories, as well as a wardrobe and exercise nook. The water in the bathroom ran so hot that I nearly scalded myself. For my entertainment, there was a small library of printed books, mostly classics, and all of them conveniently in their early Russish or late Russian or English editions. There was a digital library, with a searchable database accessed by a fold-out keyboard suspiciously similar to the ones we used in Sun Hollow. One of the lounge walls was configured to act as a false window, showing the view beyond Scythe's hull, but it could as easily show ocean breakers, or a mountaintop sunset, or a million other supposedly soothing scenes. The facilities met all my needs and more. It was almost a shame that I would be making so little use of them. Glass assured me that I was not a prisoner, and as soon as I had explored the room, washed and dressed, there were fresh garments in the wardrobe and they fitted me perfectly, I tried leaving my quarters. Nothing prevented me. I walked in every direction for as far as I could, until I was certain that I had explored every possibility at least twice. I found the hibernaculum, with two waiting reefer-sleep caskets. I found a sort of games room or weapons testing range, and near to it, another room full of weapons stored behind walls of opaque glass, so that all I could make out were murky silhouettes. In another part, I came upon a corridor that ended in a partition inset with a small window, with a bright space beyond it. I peered through the window and saw what, at first, I imagined to be a kind of engine room, filled with a mass of beguiling, mirror-surfaced machinery. Spherical robots were toiling in and around the machinery, slipping between blade-like vanes and corkscrewing helices that made me think of some immense turbine, stilled for now, but capable of whirling into lethal motion. It could not be an engine room, though, or at least nothing resembling a conventional engine. I had seen little enough of Scythe from outside, as it hovered over Michaelmas. But that glimpse had been enough to identify the basic cruciform outline of a ship built according to conjoiner principles, with a pointed hull and two outriggers upon which were mounted conjoiner engines. Glass had mentioned that they were dark drives, but my instinct told me that this was a variation on the basic technology, rather than something entirely new. The partition had no hinges or visible seals in it, but that did not preclude it becoming a door upon the right command. Yet, despite my curiosity as to the room's contents, I felt an instinctive disinclination to go beyond the partition. A prickling intuition told me that something was going on in that space that was neither safe nor wise, and I wondered what it said about the sanity of my host. That was the only visible part of the ship to which I was denied immediate access. And yet it could be no accident that I had been allowed to get exactly as close as the window, but no nearer. If Glass did not want me to see what was happening in that chamber, she could easily have denied me access to this whole area of the ship, or just made the partition opaque. She had done neither of those things, and I did not for a moment imagine it was through simple oversight or neglect. Glass was content, willing even,
for me to see the thing that the robots were working on, and that fact alone told me that it figured in my future, or at least the future that she thought she had planned for me. I touched the glass, felt an astral coldness, then backed off and resumed my explorations. I went as far as I could, along straight corridors and curved passages, through junctions and nodes, and at every point I tried to visualize myself as a small moving dot within the form of Scythe, attempting to build a mental map. But the ship's layout was disorientating, the task hopeless. I had been denied no apparent point of entry, except for that partition itself, and except for what I saw through the glass, I had come across nothing that looked delicate or dangerous enough to be a promising candidate for sabotage. I did not want to die, but if I had found a means of crippling the ship, forcing Glass to return to Sun Hollow, even if that did no more than buy me time until she once again bettered us, I would gladly have taken it. Perhaps it was something in the wine, or the food, or it might be the accumulation of recent days, but eventually fatigue got the better of me. I gave up exploring, accepting that Glass was in complete control of my surroundings, and returned to my bedroom. It was easily found, as if the ship had detected my intentions and opened up a helpful shortcut within itself. A fog of tiredness sent me under the sheets, but not before I sat at the fold-down keyboard and attempted one query, typing in a word and seeing what Scythe had to say to me. The word was Cydonia. A moment later, the system responded, an image appearing of the rust-red face of a small, airless planet, before zooming in on a part of that planet where a random conjunction of geological events had produced something eerily similar to a human face, staring back at me with blank eye sockets that reminded me of nothing other than Glass herself. Superimposed over that image, in green russish text, Cydonia, region of Mars, first system. See also Knights of Cydonia. See also Conjoiner Coalition War. See also Neville Clavaine. I slept badly. I had been ripped from my home, torn from the two people I most loved in the universe. I had been severed from the community I had helped build, the 5,000 faces that might be all that was left of humanity. In place of family life and the consoling obligations of work and duty, the almost comforting grind of daily worries and pressures, I had been granted the company of a ghoul-faced, psychological tormentress and a dark, dangerous ship I neither understood nor trusted. It was not what she had done to me that I found most troubling. Not the sundering from my people, not the flight from Sun Hollow, not the confinement aboard Scythe. It was the little cracks she was opening up in myself, fine as the flaws in tooth enamel, and just as surely with the promise of agony to come.
"Good morning, Miguel."
Glass was sitting at the table, finishing off a glass of squeezed fruit.
"I trust everything was to your satisfaction?"
"If it wasn't, would it make any difference?"
"Ah."
She nodded peremptorily, confirming some inner suspicion.
"I see that we're going to continue in that vein. I'd rather hope that a good night's rest would have put you in a more agreeable mood."
"You mean a more subservient one?"
"I'd rather think in terms of cooperation. Still, how about a little diversion of a breakfast? Sit down, please."
As I took my chair, I said, "Neville Clavaine was a knight of Cydonia."
"Was he now?"
"But of course you'll know that I know that. There's no way in hell you'd let me access Scythe's data systems without keeping a record of my queries."
"And what did you make of your little detour into early history?"
"You tell me."
"He was an interesting figure,"
Glass mused.
"First, a staunch enemy of the Conjoiners, one of the highest-ranking figures in the Coalition for Neural Purity. But something happened to turn him. We know that he was captured and held prisoner by Galliana, the enemy's leader. But he eventually returned to his own side and appeared to still believe in the cause. Something must have changed in him, though. Some little seed of doubt planted during the period of capture."
I read a little further. "He didn't defect without provocation."
"No?"
Glass asked, as if she did not already have the facts laid out like a schematic. There was a peace mission. Clavain went down to Mars to talk the conjoiners into accepting some kind of treaty. At that point, he was still fully aligned with his own cause. But elements in his own side were working to sabotage the peace initiative. Clavain was deemed expendable in that effort. They set him up to die, making it look as if the conjoiners were to blame. History tells us that he survived, though, and the fact of that betrayal was obviously sufficient to shift his loyalty to Galliana. Glass widened the black pools of her eyes.
The betrayal must have stung.
I suppose that it did.
The architect of that betrayal must have been very glad when Clavain took his leave from human affairs.
Do you think so? Without waiting for her answer, I added, Here's another question, Glass. You dropped that reference into our conversation for a reason, like a depth charge, trying to sound something out, but I'm afraid it didn't have the effect you desired.
I'm sure that it didn't. Of course, it's a little telling you felt the need to query, Scythe.
Because I'm still trying to figure you out, and if you throw me a bone, I'll follow it, even if it leads to a dead end from history.
Well, I think all we were talking about was the usefulness of the military mind. I picked a bad example, is all. I'm sorry if it touched anything raw.
It didn't. But I shook my head, exasperated by Glass and even more frustrated by my own reaction to her. How easily I felt played. But you're wrong, anyway.
How so?
A man like that isn't any use to anyone, now or then. We're fighting monsters. We don't have to become monsters ourselves.
Let us hope, then, that we haven't already done so.
She passed me the other glass of squeezed fruit and then whipped a cloth away from the thing in the middle of the table. It was the pegboard game we had played in the infirmary, set up for the start of play. Not the game itself, unless Glass had spirited it along with her, but an indistinguishably precise replica.
And to prove that I am not the monster you may think, I'm prepared to offer you back your family.
I shook my head, refusing to accept any part of that statement. If you want to mess with my head, Glass, do it some other way. I'm resigned. You wouldn't have gone to all that trouble only to throw me back.
Ah, but my word is my bond, and I'm perfectly sincere in this. I told you I like games. We'll play 3 rounds. If you win 2 of those rounds, I'll turn this ship around and take us back to Sun Hollow. You can go home. Live happy ever after.
She made a tiny doubtful pucker of her lips.
Well, apart from the wolves, of course. But if I win 2 rounds, we continue to my next port of call.
Some foolish part of me played along. Is that Charybdis?
No. There's some small business I have to attend to first, in another system. You needn't be woken for any part of that. But of course, you can avoid all that by taking me on.
I shook my head, refusing to be drawn in. I don't believe for a second that you'll honour your promise if I win. Glass sighed.
You have a choice here. We'll either play the game or we won't. If we don't, we'll go straight into the hibernaculum. If you do play, there's an outside possibility that you'll see Nicola and Victorine again. And I'll make it a fairer contest. I can handicap myself, deallocating neural resources.
With a fatal, guarded interest, I asked, by how much? Glass looked pleased.
I'll start with a figure, a percentage handicap. I'll make my opening offer generous, but I'll be reducing that handicap by 1% for every second that passes. The sooner you jump in, the better your advantage. But you'll need to be quick about it.
Wait too long, and I'll be playing with almost no handicap at all. I know this is meaningless, I said, sighing as well. But if there's even a tiny chance that you can be beaten, and that you'll honour your promise, I'm compelled to try. Glass nodded emphatically.
Right answer.
Start your damned reverse auction.
I shall. 15%.
Accept, I said, jumping in before she had a chance to say another word. Glass favoured me with a tight-lipped, approving nod.
That was much quicker than I expected.
My opening bid wasn't,
too low for you? Of course it was too low. What difference is a 15% handicap likely to make? But it was the best offer I was going to get. It's vastly in your favour, but it's still better than no advantage at all.
You aren't the first I've played this auction game with,
Glass confided. You'd be surprised how many don't see things as clearly as you did. Others hesitate. Perhaps they don't trust you enough to take the game seriously.
But you did.
No, but a poor chance in a weighted game is better than no chance at all. Shall we get this over with? Glass let me have the first game. Or perhaps I won it by legitimate means. She was playing well, but so was I. The difference between this time and the game in the infirmary was that I gave no quarter from the outset. In the infirmary, I had been playing to keep her amused, not taking it seriously until she began to better me, by which point it was far too late to turn the tide. Now I went in hard, straining to think as many moves ahead as possible, and drawing on the memories of 1,000 games won and lost against Nicola and Victorine. It was not about the fates of individual pegs, but the disposition of pieces as a whole. But the second game went to Glass. I held her off for as long as I could, and at one point thought I had her cornered, but it proved a false dawn. She responded cleverly, and soon had me pinned down. I managed to drag out the inevitable for a few more moves, but the game was all but decided. She had bettered me, and yet I could not deny that the game had felt fairly won. I had played against machines, and knew the feeling of losing to an algorithm. Glass was not like that. I only ever felt that I was playing against a person, one who was both ruthless and extremely quick to learn and adapt. Defeated, I leaned back in my chair. You knew you'd beat me, even with half your brain switched off.
But I haven't beaten you. Not just yet. We're even. Both a game up. The third is the decider.
I've nothing left to play.
You've also nothing left to lose. We've each learned from each other. Either of us could make an error. Either of us could stumble on a surprising move.
I sighed, shook my head, but set up the pegs on my side of the board while Glass did hers. Glass permitted me to make the starting move. I accepted and embarked on a counterintuitive opening, one that opened up an initial weakness in my flank. It looked like a bid to end the game quickly, but I had lulled Nicola into a similar false security, and it had not gone well for her. I doubted there was much hope of Glass falling into the same trap, but it seemed to offer marginally better odds than a continuation of my earlier style of play. It worked for a little while. Glass was thrown. She could dig into the bag of moves she had learned from me, and find that none of them were applicable to this new configuration. She had to improvise, and in doing so she opened up a subtle vulnerability of her own, one that it took my own experience to recognize and exploit. I retaliated, treating her as callously as she had treated me, and I began to methodically shatter her defenses. But as we each depleted our opponent's pieces, so the game fell into a more familiar pattern, and Glass was again able to draw on her developing library of moves and sequences of moves. There came a point where all my instincts told me I was beaten, but I strove not to show it, playing with all the intensity and concentration I had brought to the game from the outset. Glass won. I had bloodied her, but not enough, and the tournament was hers.
That was instructive,
she said, packing away the pegboard. To see how gullible I was to ever think you would let me win.
On the contrary, to see how determined you were until the last. I've a small confession to make.
You cheated?
No. I kept to my promise. But I had Scythe run a non-invasive scan of your neural workflow during all three games. I wanted to see how seriously you were taking it. The answer pleases me. You gave your all, right until the end. No one could have played more valiantly, more determinedly.
This proves something?
It proves that I was right about you. You'll fight until the bitter end, until your last breath, no matter how the odds seem to be stacked against you.
I was ready to give in.
But you didn't, which is the important thing. I'll be frank. After that first game we just played, there was very little likelihood of you winning. But the probability wasn't zero.
Would you have honored your promise?
I like to think so.
I wondered if that was the first truly sincere thing that had come from her lips since our acquaintance. But you can't be sure.
Under the circumstances, I'd have honoured the pledge, and then looked at other means of persuasion. It wouldn't have pleased me to lose you, especially now I know how tenaciously you'll fight.
Glass rose from the table, leaving the pegboard where it stood.
Come, there's nothing to prevent us going directly to the hibernaculum. It will be easier for you once you're on the other side of reefer sleep.
Glass extended a hand across the table, beckoning me to my feet. I got up and moved along the table until we were both at the same end of it. I cowed my head, faking submission, ready to be led to my fate. I doubted very much that she was convinced by it, especially if Scythe was still looking into my skull, reading brain activity. My intentions would have been obvious to the dimmest machine. Still, it was all I had. I lunged, planting my left hand around her throat and punching her beneath the ribs with my right. Glass crashed back against the wall behind her. I redoubled the pressure on her throat and pushed hard into her abdomen. Glass got her right arm up, balled her fist, and punched me across the face. She followed through with her elbow, jabbing into my throat. Something crunched somewhere in my larynx or windpipe. I drew a breath, and nothing came. Glass wrenched my hand away from her throat, raised a knee, and kicked me in the groin. I went tumbling back into the table, hitting its edges with a spine-jarring crack. I tried to snatch another breath, and still nothing came. Glass laughed. It was a deep, broken, wet-throated laugh, like a tumble of rocks in a bucket. She got a foot up and kept me pressed against the table, bent backwards, so that it would only take a little more pressure to snap my spine.
You know, she paused, rubbing at her neck. You know, I'd have been ever so slightly disappointed if you hadn't tried that.
I made a wheezing sound. A straw's worth of air must have reached my lungs.
I'll keep trying.
But not here.
Not today. Today, you sleep.
Glass yanked me up as six or seven of her white globes came into the room. They bustled around me, pinning me with their multi-jointed manipulators. I wrestled against them, but I had no strength left in my limbs. Glass gave no audible command to the spheres, but they knew what to do with me. Scooping me up like a doll, no part of me able to touch any surface, they conveyed me to the hibernaculum. We got there easily, as if the labyrinthine puzzle of the ship had straightened itself out overnight. The two caskets waited for their occupants, side by side, and set at 45 degrees to the floor. They were chrome-green cocoons, fluted with radiator fins, controlled pedestals next to each. Instead of the lidded casket that had brought Glass to Sun Hollow, these units peeled open along their midsections, with interlocking hinged petals waiting to close over again and form an impervious seal. I might as well have been a drowsy baby being lowered into a crib for all the resistance I was able to muster. The idea of fighting was still there. It was just that my body had already surrendered. The spheres busied around me with surprising tenderness, while Glass stood by and watched, hands on hips. I managed to croak,
"You said you had business in some other system. Where?"
"You don't need to worry your little head about that. I still want to know if I matter to you. Give me that much."
Glass looked at me with a distant species of pity.
"Oh, very well. We'll be making a short stopover in the Yellowstone system, around Epsilon Eridami. I've made arrangements to collect some items of importance."
"Items?"
"Gideon stones."
"I'm afraid that means nothing to me."
"I'd be concerned if it did."
"What are Gideon stones, Glass?"
She leaned in a little, as if she were about to whisper a lullaby.
"They're going to help us murder some wolves. Quite a lot of wolves, if all goes well."
"I saw something through a window. All blades and helices."
"Ah, you saw that, did you?"
"You know what I saw."
I wheezed against the effort of speaking.
"You've controlled what happens to me since I came aboard this ship. What is that thing?"
"Oh, you do like to spoil a surprise."
"I suppose I do."
She sighed as if I had taken the fun out of a parlor game.
It's something else that will help us. Not so much a weapon as something that will make a weapon. But for it to work the way it needs to, we must have the Gideon stones.
Glass touched a finger to the black cupid's bow of her upper lip.
But I'll take care of that, little man. Rest now. I can't have you worrying. You can stay asleep while I take care of the stones. I want you rested. You'll need all the strength of mind and body you can get for when you meet them.
Them.
The pattern jugglers,
Glass said, as if that was the fullest answer that I could reasonably expect.